You're listening to RTE Lyric Live with the National Symphony Orchestra.
Over the next 20 minutes, I'd like us to get thinking about the sound, and specifically the timbre, of the human voice in the last several centuries. Sure, the voice is the oldest instrument played, as it were, by humans. We share this affinity for vocal sounds with many other members of the animal world. But birds and other animals haven't changed the way they produce their chirps, nor the styles of their songs in the last 700 years the way we humans have. When we hear the music of Hildegard of Bingen, Henry Purcell, Handel, Bach, Mozart, Rossini, Berlioz, or Strauss being sung, why are the vocal styles so different? Now, as devil's advocate, I can argue that anything we sing in this day and age is of this age, and that's absolutely true. I'm still a 21st century singer doing my thing, no matter how stylistically I sing medieval French or romantic Italian music, or how many ideas about historical performance I put into practice. But each musical period in the West was known for its different fashions. Fashions about the place where songs were sung, and the role of musical sound versus text. Let's start off with some of the earlier stuff.
Canerba fresca il foglia par e la flor spotò nel fergia. Carina mettan mi dat no destre. Abans che io foste il desire restance.
As you could hear in Paul Hillier's recording of Bernard de Ventadurin's song, Can l'erba fresca il foglia par, the troubadours and trouvères of France were all about poetry, and for them, the words were the absolute priority. It doesn't mean that they couldn't write beautiful melodies. As you can tell from the last piece, they were fine tunesmiths. But they wanted to make sure listeners could hear the meter and meaning of their poems. They also most likely sang these songs in close quarters, where kings held court and not in a large church, and certainly not a stage. Those weren't quite yet the thing. Some medieval composers wanted to show off both the words and the voices, so their melodies were especially suited to display those voices. Take a listen to this. Ave Maria o Auctrix Vitae, sung there by Heather Knutson, soloist, with members of Vox Femine, the female cohort of Sequentia Ensemble for Medieval Music. They've recorded the entire body of music by Hildegard of Bingen, one of the West's earliest female composers. Her music was meant to carry the meaning of her poems, which spoke of visions and revelations, but she had at her disposal a group of novices at her monastery in Rupertsburg, Germany, young and usually well-off singers. Hildegard wrote melodies that really showed off the ranges of these singers and effectively delivered the texts in the resonant acoustic of a medieval monastery's church. By the time the 13th century rolls around, the embellishment of vocal sound is getting more important than the words. In late medieval Paris, the Cathedral of Notre-Dame was home to an elite group of hotshot cantors who were adept at improvising a form of vocal music called organum. These were jazz-like improvisations over the sustained notes of a pre-existing chant line, and some of them were dizzying in their florid complexity. Paul Elliott was the soloist with Theatre of Voices, singing the florid organum sections of Propter Veritatem by the 12th century Parisian composer Leoninus, also known as Leonin. Renaissance vocalism got back to basics. Text was the driving force of songs, and music its handmaid. Lute songs, French air de cour, and Italian monody of the 16th and 17th century are all examples of this tendency. But as the 1600s approached, kings, dukes, and other wealthy types created large, extravagant events that included musical semi-staged performances, high-flying entertainers, and more. The Italians called these stravaganze, and they were the forerunners to modern opera. Claudio Monteverdi crystallized this style with his Rappresentazione in Musica, such as Orfeo and L'Incoronazione di Poppea, and florid singing once again started to elbow its way to the front of the stage. But the spaces that these early operas were performed in were not so huge. Dublin's National Concert Hall would have seemed cavernous compared to them. The florid lines that Monteverdi and his contemporaries wrote were perfectly suited to these spaces, which showed off the vocalism of singers as much as their commitment to expressing the text. The rapid-fire ornaments in these arias worked best in medium-sized spaces, however. Take a listen to this excerpt from Monteverdi's 1607 opera, Orfeo. King's Consort and Charles Daniels performing a section of Orfeo's aria Possente Spirito, an athletic display of ornamentation prowess. Between the 1600s and the mid-1700s, Western art song and opera continued these showy trends of vocalism, a period known, of course, as the Baroque. Lovers of Handel know that the Anglo-German composer was a king of elaborate decorative passages, and he composed these ornate arias for spaces as large as opera halls or concert rooms as reasonably sized as the Bull's Head Music Hall on Fishamble Street here in Dublin, where The Messiah was premiered. What Monteverdi, Handel, and the other Baroque composers were following was a vocal expressive ideal propagated in the late 16th century by the likes of Giulio Caccini and his circle. Bel canto, literally, beautiful singing. Although the term now refers to the style of singing used for 19th century opera standards, it was originally used to describe the aesthetic of vocalism espoused by the composers of 16th and 17th century Italy, inspired by a balance of strength and beauty with roots in Greco-Roman art and philosophy. As you've heard so far, the types of voices and timbres used for these earlier repertoires share some similarities with what's used for singing Verdi and Puccini. But the differences soon become apparent. What happened between Monteverdi and Giuseppe Verdi? Well, for one, the patronage of operas came much more under the influence of emperors and other politicos. The size of theaters under Joseph II of Austria, for example, was about 1,350 for Vienna's Burgtheater and 1,800 for the Kentner Tor Theater. Contrast that with the room which premiered Monteverdi's Orfeo in the Ducal Palace in Mantua. That room, the Sala dei Fiumi, was formerly a refectory, essentially a refurbished cafeteria meant for holding around 100 diners. So, what kind of vocal music would have been written for these larger spaces? Here's a perfect example. Soprano Renee Fleming singing Ach, ich liebte, war so glücklich, a florid example of an aria from the Abduction from the Seraglio, an opera which Emperor Joseph II commissioned from Mozart and was premiered in the Viennese Burgtheater I mentioned earlier. Singing showy, florid, or sustained lines in a space holding 1,500 seats requires a different sort of resonance in order to provide the acoustic power needed to carry over an orchestra, which, by the way, had also grown in size and volume between the 17th and 18th centuries. In order to get the voice to carry more, a singer emphasizes certain parts of their vocal color or timbre. In classical singing, where beauty of tone quality is goal numero uno, you usually do this in a couple of ways. Passing over consonants quickly, singing as long as possible on the vowels, connecting sung notes fluidly, and oftentimes modifying vowels slightly so you get a vocal color that carries over other sounds. This last trick is accomplished thanks to a little acoustic phenomenon called the singer's formant. If the voice were a stereo unit, you could think of it as adjusting a single slider on an audio equalizer so that part of the sound is heard above all else. It gives opera singers voices that ring that allows their single voice to carry over an orchestra in a big room. The only trouble is that to get this singer's formant ringing, and on the high notes in particular, you sometimes have to sacrifice the clarity of the words. Vowels start getting a bit wonky, and everything starts sounding more like the stereotypical operatic la la la, since the ah vowel is one of the friendlier vowels for high amplification. If you don't make resonance adjustments at high volume, the voice can sound screechy and shouty, and you start risking vocal damage in the worst case. A composer might have all the best intentions in the world in clearly setting the words of an aria, but by the time you get to high pitches at high volume in big spaces, singers are forced to make choices in order to stay sounding beautiful. And as a listener, you sometimes have to suspend your disbelief regarding the words. A great example of this is Mozart's extremely well-known aria, Die Hölle Rache, known to most of us as the Queen of the Night aria. Listen to that coloratura passage that we all know so well. Can you guess the words? That section that goes up to the soprano's high F, Diana Damrau sings the word nimmermehr, nevermore, and that closed A sound is pretty much indistinguishable from an ah. And no wonder, at that pitch and volume, a voice can do little else than that. After readjusting vowels, connecting the phrases, and smoothing out the consonants, the vocal sounds we end up with are the stylistic stamp of modern-day classical singing. The old term bel canto was reappropriated in the 19th century to describe this way of singing, but because this variety of vocalism deals with high levels of volume and often uses a relatively wide vibrato rate, it's often derided with the term can belto. Nevertheless, fashions and changing tastes are still at the heart of it all. What sounded too straight-toned just 20 years ago is used to great effect by bel canto operatic singers as part of their palette of colors and vocal timbres. Voices dedicated to early repertoires have, more often than not, trained in modern opera and perform medieval through baroque vocal music with great style and personal authenticity. All it takes to bring about a change in fashions is an openness on the part of artists to try out things outside of their usual stylistic comfort zones, and a public willing to expand their tastes. I'm Vlad Smyshkevich, and I hope that I've left you with some thoughts about how the sound of the human voice has changed in the last centuries according to uses, contexts, and fashions.
You're listening to RTE Lyric Live with the National Symphony Orchestra.